This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined by Bradley Chambers. We're without a sponsor this week, but if you want to sponsor the show, you can get in touch with us through our website, outofschool.net. Afternoon, Bradley. How are you?
I am great. It is a rainy Sunday morning here in Tennessee. We're getting some much-needed rain, so I'm staring out the window on a weekend and watching my leaves get wet.
Mm-hmm. Well, we, like I said to you just before we started the show, we've just recovered from a period of freezing weather here in Scotland, so that's quite welcome.
It has been unseasonably warm this time of year in Chattanooga. We had a really cold week last week, but like right now it's 52 degrees, and so for it to be a Sunday morning, or I guess late morning, it is quite warm, all things considered.
All right, so winter is here. This is also going to be our last show before 2013. We're going to take a little break, the week of Christmas and the week of New Year, and we'll be back in January, second week of January, with a new show. So, last thing, I guess, are we getting news to talk about? I don't know what's, has much happened recently?
No, not too much. You know, it's funny to see, I'm seeing a lot of apps be updated this past week because the iTunes App Store holiday is, I believe, the 21st is when that begins. So you're seeing a lot of developers rush apps to get updated for the holidays because that's a really big time of year. You know, it also can be dangerous because if you've got a relatively stable version and then you push something that has an unknown bug, all the people that get iOS devices for Christmas can potentially, you know, run into problems, and that can potentially lead to a lot of bad reviews.
Yeah, and I think if I remember right, the rankings get frozen round about Christmas time as well. And this is always EA's trick, isn't it, with their games, is that they cut everything to the lowest possible price level just before Christmas, so that on Christmas Day, all their apps are top of the charts and they make a killing off people who get new devices for Christmas.
Yeah, of course, I always love sales. You kind of can't beat it. Yeah, it seems like games especially are that way, especially ones without server-side components. Because, I mean, if you're EA and you normally sell the game for $5 and to one person, or if you could sell it, you know, 50 of them at 99 cents, why not? Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't have any extra cost in selling one versus 50.
Yep. I'm definitely holding out for the 2013 version of FIFA Soccer.
Well, I don't. I play Madden, and I don't understand why they have never put out a 2013 version of it. I really am perplexed because I would have easily. Well, I'm sorry, they did put out one, but it was a social version. Oh. Never mind. I do not like that trend with games. I just want to pay $5 or $10 and just let me own it and don't do any in-app purchases, don't have social aspects. I just want to play, you know, American football.
Yeah, there's a thing, I think, with the last version of FIFA, or maybe it was Tiger Woods game that came out. It came out for free, but there was all kinds of in-app purchases. But then there was something I played recently. Oh no, it was that game CSR Racing, which is a kind of drag racing game. And literally, you would spend like 30 seconds doing the drag race, and then you spend nearly a minute clicking through. No, I don't want to sign into this service. No, I don't want to tweet my most recent time until you could get another race, and it was so frustrating.
I'm currently playing. I'm not a big gamer, but I'm a sucker for retro games. And Grand Theft Auto Vice City came out last week or the week before. And it's $5, full game, no ads, no sign into social services. And I really just, that's what I want to do. And maybe I'm old school. I guess maybe I'm showing my age a little bit. But I just want to, like, I want to give a developer money, then I would like to play the game. And I just don't like the, okay, we're going to sell it to you for 99 cents, but then you could unlock everything for 20. Just charge 25 for it, and if it's a good game, I'll buy it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. Maybe the kids like something different these days, but I want to be antisocial sometimes, and games are one way I want to do that.
Well, and my Twitter followers do not care what my high score is in, you know, said racing game. They're not very, very much not interested in that.
Yeah. That's a whole other question, is, you know, selling out your friend's attention for digital things and games. An emerging question of ethics, I think.
Yeah, that's where the block client in Tweetbot comes in handy.
Oh, I could not use Twitter without that.
I was trying an experiment last week. I wanted to try to use Twitter for iPhone, Twitter for iPad, and Twitter for Mac, and just to kind of experience Twitter as Twitter intends. And I was amazed by the amount of increase in my timeline when I did not have the block feature, because I block a lot of services, Foursquare, things like that. I do not want to see those in my timeline. And so obviously when you're using the regular Twitter services, you don't have that. And my timeline was a lot busier.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the day that Twitter shuts the door on other clients that support things like muting and blocking specific clients, I reckon that's probably the last day I'm on Twitter. So, thing I've been doing this week, I thought we'd maybe have a chat about, Bradley, is I kicked off the process of looking into our device refresh, which is something that our lease is coming up for 3 years old. The actual official date is the end of June 2013. But as you know, you want to start these things early and have plenty of time to think about what you're going to do and also think about how you're going to do it and when you're going to do it and what you're going to do with all the data and all of these things. So I thought we would maybe just have a chat about how that's gone and what the decisions that we've made so far have been.
Now, how does it work? I know like we're currently in the same process, and kind of our process, you know, is a lot of email communication with our Apple rep. Is it similar for you guys in the UK?
It's a little different in the UK and in Europe for that matter, because I know in the US that Apple has a more direct sales model. So you have an Apple rep, and can you talk to him about actual purchases?
Absolutely.
Is that how it works for you?
Yeah, they've kind of been revamping that, and we have an outside sales rep, and they kind of cover, the way it works in the US, they kind of cover, you know, three or four different states, and there's a separate rep for public and private schools. And it used to not be that way, but now what they've done, instead of having one rep cover, say, two states, they have a public and private separate rep, and they cover, you know, maybe four or five states. So she'll stop by usually once or twice a year, really just to check in. And then, because, you know, with Apple, it's not like generally you're buying things every week. You're going to make big purchases every few years. And then we used to have one inside sales rep, and I'm sure he covered multiple territories as well. But they've changed that in the past month, and now we have kind of a team. And so I can email our team, and one person will find it and respond. But it's a lot of email, though.
Okay, yeah. The Europe and the UK is a little bit different in that most of the actual sales work is done through resellers here. So there are people who work for Apple's education division, covering Scotland and Northern Ireland and so on. But I wouldn't necessarily talk to them about making a purchase. I would talk to them about strategy, and I'd talk to them about educational things and so on. But when I want to buy something, I'll typically go to a reseller. Now, the first time we did a release, I didn't really know any of this stuff. And, you know, I was literally just making it up. I'd never met my Apple rep before we did our one-to-one. So all I did was I worked with the business manager at the local Apple store. And because we're a private school, we can be treated as a business. Most public schools have to do something different. They have to buy through purchasing frameworks for the government, but we don't have to do that. So that was the way we did our first lease. And then after that all happened, it was kind of all these people from Apple Education came along, and they were saying, oh, you should have talked to us first and stuff, you know. And I was like, well, never heard from you guys before, so... But that's all in the past. We hear from them quite a lot now, I can tell you. So that was the way we did it at first. But this time, obviously, we're talking to more resellers. There actually are more resellers now than there were back then. There was only really one company covering most of this area. Now I'm certainly talking to three different companies now, and they're all giving me various quotes and so on. So there's plenty of competition for the business now, I guess.
Yeah, that is the direct opposite of how it works here, which is unfortunate. Because let me take you back to probably 5 years ago. This is before my time at my school, but we were, I believe, an HP school. And so the beauty of that is when you're really just buying Windows computers, so you can pit HP versus Dell versus you know, Lenovo. And of course, the way Apple Education in the U.S. works is you can only buy through them. So we do not have an Apple store within 2 hours of us. So there's a Mac Authority, which is a very popular Apple reseller in the Southeast, and then Best Buy carries Apple products as well. Well, Mac Authority cannot sell us computers using the school's tax exempt card. So obviously I could go in there and just run the school credit card through the machine, but I would still have to pay tax. So mm-hmm. Apple Education says that we must deal directly with Apple. So the downside with that is if I need something in a pinch, I am generally up creek because I have to order it through their online store or through my rep. Now, we have it on occasion when we need something. I needed a Mac Pro recently, and we did not have time to wait for it to ship. We drove to Atlanta and bought it directly at an Apple store. But right. I cannot drive to Mac Authority and purchase that. So it's kind of the direct opposite of your situation. So I've got no one to pit against anybody. We call Apple. We tell them what they want or what we want. They give us a quote, and that's it.
And that's what you're paying no matter what.
Yeah, we can haggle with them a little bit. Of course, we do the financing directly through Apple as well, and I was curious how that works for you guys. Mm-hmm. But that's where we can kind of – they've got room to negotiate. Of course, for us too, Apple has a lot more room to negotiate if you buy AppleCare. And especially on our Macs, since I have the Apple hardware certification, we always decline that. Of course, they always love to try to sneak it in on the quote, though.
Just in case you need to know. For comparison purposes.
Yeah. So do you guys do your financing through Apple or through your bank, or how does that work?
Well, the first time we did it, again, I didn't know what I was doing. So I went to the Apple store and I said, how much to lease these devices? And he said, this much. And he said, okay. And we just did it. This time, kind of obviously know a little bit more about what I'm doing. So typically what happens is we'll phone up the reseller and we'll say, we're looking for 120 of whatever device. And they'll say, okay, for that number, here's your unit price before sales tax. And I'll get you a quote from our finance people, whoever our finance people happen to be. Now, in some cases, the reseller's finance people are also Apple's finance people, Apple Financial Services, which is a sort of a branding of, I think it's GE Capital Bank in the UK, back that up. So we'll get a quote. We'll typically get a couple of quotes. One of our resellers has quoted us finance from another company, just a regular equipment leasing company, and they're fairly competitive as well. So we've got various device prices, and then we've got various quarterly repayments for the leasing as well. And it's not always been the case so far that the company with the cheapest price has got the cheapest leasing, you know? So sometimes you're better off paying a little more for the device to get to the company that's got the cheaper leasing price as well. So you have to look at it in different ways. For our internals, we tend to break it down in terms of cost per pupil per month. So at the moment, our average cost, our cost per pupil per month at the moment for our current lease is about £12.50 per pupil per month for an iPad 1. And now, with the quotes I've got at the moment, I'm looking at below £10 for the refresh. So we're going to save a good chunk regardless. And that's mainly because the iPad's cheaper now than it was before. So that's going to save us some money.
Now, this is kind of a side note. When you guys obviously buy these, are your parents charged a technology fee, or is this cost just built into the price of the tuition?
Yeah, we have always just kept that price in the tuition price. We have never broken that out as a separate fee. I know a lot of private schools, particularly in the US, do market a separate technology fee. But because we decided to get into leasing, we thought that we could just build that into our fee because we know, you know, it costs us whatever, £100 a month per pupil to have a teacher. It costs us this much to heat the school per pupil per month, and it costs us this much to provide technology. And we can just treat that as one of the costs of the school. And that's almost a philosophical point of view. You know, the computer is such a fundamental part of the school, the process of education and the life of the school, that we build that into the fee. You know, you don't have a separate teacher fee or a desk fee or a chair fee or something like that. So we decided we were not going to break that out separately. We were just going to keep it in the tuition price.
We do the same, but we are the unique person, I know, in our region that we have a one set price that includes all field trips. The only thing possibly you can add on to our tuition is we have an option where if you want to eat every day in the cafeteria for lunch, then you can add, we call it the annual lunch plan, where there's a set amount that's added to your tuition that covers lunch. Long term, that'll probably be the default. But yeah, I feel the same way you do. Just you don't break out the teachers. You don't charge them an electricity fee. Just if it's going to cost, you know, $15 a month, just figure that into the price of the tuition. It's just a fundamental aspect of what you're doing day to day. You don't charge them a paper and a pencil fee or a printing fee.
Absolutely. Yep. The thing I've been working on this week, because I've obviously been asking for quotes and stuff, is trying to decide which device we're going to go with. And of course, the first question, I guess, is whether or not it's going to be another iPad. I have written in the past on my blog and so on about what I have experienced with some other tablets that I've bought and tried. And right now, I think it's pretty clear to us that we're going to stick with the iPad at least for another cycle. Not just because we've invested a certain amount of money in, apps and so on, and Apple TV and things, but I mean, let's think it through, right? What are the choices, right? I guess the choices are iPad of some description, Kindle Fire, Nexus 7, something else running Android, some cheaper device, or potentially a Microsoft Surface tablet. Now, for one thing, the Surface tablet, there's no cost advantage to going there because it's roughly in the same ballpark of price as some of the better iPads. And also, have you tried a Surface, Bradley? I've tried one.
I have not. I am anxious to get my hands on one.
Yeah. Well, I tried a Surface RT, and I found it to be quite slow when you're using the Windows desktop applications. I found it reasonably sharp with Metro, but it was markedly slower with the other applications. And the thing I really didn't like about the Surface, though, was it's so clearly designed to be a kind of laptop that's not a laptop, you know. The whole thing only really works sensibly in the landscape orientation. It's actually physically bigger than the iPad in most respects. And it just seemed like a product that was... It's clearly a 1.0 product, you know. It's not a mature product yet. It's just coming out, so I think it would be a little bit early, in my opinion, to get into Microsoft Surface as such. So that was my first thinking: was do we go there or not? And then, of course, we've got these two other tablets: the Nexus 7 and the Kindle Fire. And I don't know. I guess there's the more I thought about it, there was really essentially two deal breakers for the Nexus 7. Three, actually, if I'm honest. Number one is there's no camera on the back of a Nexus 7. And I don't know about in your school, Bradley, but I know that here, if I told my teachers we were going for another 3 years without a camera on the back of their devices, there would be a riot. And never mind any discussions about, you know, processor architecture or memory or anything like that. If I don't deliver a camera with this next refresh, I'm going to be in so much trouble. So that's one thing that's high in my mind. The other thing with the Nexus 7 is that there's no way to connect it to a projector. As far as I know, it just has this USB connector on the bottom. There's no real Android equivalent of an Apple TV that you could do this wirelessly yet. I believe Samsung are working on something that does that, but my understanding is it's not available yet. And the final thing that I thought was a deal breaker for the Nexus 7 was just its physical size and shape. And it has this 16x10 widescreen display, which is great if you're watching a movie. But my biggest complaint with the Nexus 7 was that when you bring up the keyboard in the horizontal mode, you've got such a tiny little strip of screen left to see any content on that it becomes a very difficult device to use in that mode. So that was really where I came down on the Nexus 7. And as for the Kindle Fire, well, my sense is that, we know this for a fact, that Amazon are selling the Kindle Fire at close to cost, if not below cost, if you count R&D. And it seems to me, having used the Kindle Fire for a little while in the store nearby, all the design decisions in the main interface of that product are really built around showing you more content that you could buy next. You know, there's recommended things here and so on. And there's a lot of design that's all about helping you access your Amazon content, but also find more ones to buy. And to me, it just didn't feel right as a general purpose computer for schools, because the storefront never really kind of got out your face enough that you could kind of do your things. So, also, again, there's also things about it being small and so on. And yes, it's cheaper, but its price isn't the only factor. I mean, price matters, of course, to everybody, but it's not the only factor in these decisions. So that was where I've kind of been thinking about these products over, I guess, recent months, I suppose, since the whole tablet thing has kind of blown up in other markets.
Yeah, I think it's quite healthy to always step back and try to get out of our love of iOS and say, is there something better, not for just me, but for our schools? Because if you, you know, if you have your head kind of in the sand, this is what we do, this is what we do, you know, something else may, you know, in another 3 years, the Surface may be a near perfect device for your school. And so it's always mm-hmm. healthy to have those, I guess, even conversations internally in your head as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I've spent some of my own money on different devices to try and figure out, has the market changed since the last time I made an analysis? And I found when I used the Nexus 7, I expected to like the hardware and hate Android. And in fact, I found that Android, the operating system, was actually really quite good. But I didn't like the hardware. And there are certain, you know, one of the big things about the Nexus 7 is its price. And clearly there are many things that have, decisions have been made in that to keep it at that price, including things like no back camera, no advanced graphics circuitry to talk to a bigger display or anything like that. So, you know, I mean, Nexus 7 is fine, right? But my other big complaint about it was, you know, and this is the thing I keep talking about, is this idea of the GarageBand test. You know, where's your platform's equivalent of GarageBand? Show me iMovie, show me iPhoto, show me Pages and Keynote and Numbers and OmniFocus and so on and so on and so on. You know, thinking about the core applications that are essential to the kind of life and running of the school, where are those applications for the Nexus 7? Where is an explain everything for the Nexus 7? And honestly, those apps are just not there yet. I'm not saying they can never be built for Android, but I am saying that they are not being built right now. And to sign a long lease for devices where you know even at the start that they're not as good as another device, I think is a really, really big risk. And it's not one that I'm particularly confident about taking right now.
I think it goes back to a fundamental understanding of Apple's business model and then a Google/Amazon, where Apple is profitable because of their hardware. So they're interested in making their hardware as great as possible with the greatest applications as possible. So when the time comes again, you'll keep buying that hardware. Where Google obviously is an ad-driven model, then Amazon is obviously to sell you more Amazon content. Mm-hmm. And while you could argue that a cheap tablet, a lower priced tablet may be great for great Aunt Susie, you know, what is the best for your school? Something that is profitable because of its hardware, or something that is profitable because of selling more things, or an ad driven model?
Yeah, you know, in some ways, you know, the Kindle Fire is a wee bit like that app that always wants you to buy an in-app purchase. You know, it's everything, and it's the business pressure for Amazon developers is always going to be, how do we show people more things to buy? And the business pressure for Google developers is going to be, how do we give people a good experience so they keep either sharing data with Google or looking at adverts? And this is not that hard to work out. I mean, it's public knowledge how all of these things are being funded and built. And to pretend that we're ignorant of this, I think is wrong, that we should recognize where each company makes their money. And that's not to say that Apple, what's the pressure for Apple developers? Well, the pressure for Apple developers is that they need us to keep buying new devices, right? So, you know, what does that mean? There's going to be a lifespan. You know, let's talk about lifespan. Let's, you know, move on to the question of, okay, we're looking at iPads now. Which iPad are we looking at? Which one's going to give us the lifespan that we need over the course of this next lease? And that's a more complicated question than it first seems. Because, I mean, what choices do we have, right? We've got iPad mini. The iPad 2 is still available in a 16 gig configuration. And there's a fourth generation iPad, which is available in all the configurations. So which one's going to last the longest, right? I've got to make it through to summer of 2016 on this device. Which one's Apple going to support the longest? What do you think, Bradley?
I wish I had about 6 months to answer this, because it'd be really, you'd like to see what happens. I'd like to see what happens with iOS 7 and what I'm assuming the iPad 2 will get it, but will it be all the features, or will it turn into the iPhone 3GS that kind of stays around year after year, but it keeps getting fewer and fewer features? And so you don't want to be in a situation in a year and a half with the iPad 2 where you're already feeling growing pains.
Yeah.
And I think that goes back to our leasing question. You know, obviously for a Christmas present for your mom, a $399 or $329 mini, a $399 iPad 2 or a $500 iPad 4th generation, well, you can really, you know, $100 at Christmas time can make or break the difference. But if you go back to look at understanding a lease and understanding the, you know, fundamental business of a school finance office, cash flow is king. And it's not so much about, you know, what's the individual price of the device, but what does this do to our lease payment? And absolutely. what is the difference between let's not talk about the mini necessarily, but let's look at, let's say you said, okay, we're going 10-inch iPad. What does, you know, how many are you looking at, for example?
So we were at least 120 units.
So what does the lease of 120 iPad 2s versus, let's say, a 32-gigabyte fourth generation iPad? You know, what does that do to your lease price? What does that do to your cash flow every month? And that, I think that's, it's a more complicated question. But if I had to guess, I mean, if it was my school, I don't necessarily think I would be looking at iPad 2s, not on a 3-year lease, but possibly if you could do a shorter lease and could make the numbers work, and then possibly get something else, maybe.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. We made that decision as well. We decided we're not going to look at the iPad mini this time. And the thinking behind that was that we have gone all in on iPad. We don't have a computer lab in the school anymore. Everything that kids are going to do on a computer, they're going to do on an iPad, more or less. There's a couple of laptops floating about that they can get for things they need to, but I would say that 99% of everything the kids do in school is done on an iPad now. And we really need that to be everything. And remember also that our school is 5 to 18. So what I would really like to be able to do is just have one pool of identical devices that I can reallocate to any part of the school. Because we're also a small school, the proportion of kids in primary versus secondary changes substantially each year. You know, if a big class goes through to secondary will grow to a bigger proportion of the school. You know, otherwise, if a lot of people leave at the end of secondary school, then we may have more kids in primary. And if we said something like, well, it's iPad mini for primary kids and iPad 4 for secondary kids, then that's fine for the first year. I can get that absolutely right the first year. But the second year, I've got a different proportion of primary and secondary kids, so I need a different proportion of devices, except I can't do that because I've leased. So what am I going to do? Well, you know, then I say, well, okay, 3 kids in primary this year get an iPad 4, and then there's a complaint from the other parents who aren't getting iPad 4s, and you see what happens in the second year and the third year. You've got to think these things through. So my desire is to have one device for everybody, and I think that leads me to think it's got to be one of the 10-inch iPads. Now, if we had had this conversation back in August or September, this would have been an easy conversation, because you would have clearly said, well, the third generation iPad as it was then, that's the one to get, because the iPad 2 is clearly on its way out. Except that I don't think that's any longer true. And I'll tell you why I think that's no longer true, is because the iPad mini has basically resurrected from the dead the A5 architecture and kept it going. It basically brought it back to life as a supported architecture for iPads. Because if you think about it, the iPad mini and the iPad 2 are basically the same device. They're A5 processors, they're 512 megs of RAM, and they're non-Retina. And Apple's going to sell who knows how many, 10 million possibly, iPad minis in the first year, maybe well more than that, I don't know. But the point being that if you sell an iPad mini at Christmas 2012, you can't cut that device off 1 year in. You know, the iPad 2 is a 2011 device. March 2011 was when it came out. So March 2012, March 2013, the iPad 1 got 2.5 years of software support. So by rights, the iPad 2 should be getting cut off towards the end of 2013. Okay, but if you're going to cut off, in what world does it make sense to cut off the iPad 2 and but keep the support for the iPad mini going when they're essentially the same device? And if Apple can keep that iPad 2 production line going and get the price down and down and down, that's going to be good for them, as long as the A5 architecture is good enough to do most of what they want. And yes, there are certain other differences between the iPad mini and the iPad 2, notably cameras and networking hardware. But apart from that, at their core, for running apps, they're basically the same machine. So it's more of an open question today than it was 3 or 4 months ago as to whether the latest iPad or the iPad 2 is the one you're going to go for. So it's more of a nuanced decision than it used to be. In the end, we decided that we were going to go fourth generation iPad. And the reason for that was partly performance. It is substantially faster. If you look at the benchmarks between the iPad 2 or even the iPad 3 and the fourth generation iPad, the fourth generation is scoring about 1,700 points on Geekbench, and the previous generation and the iPad 2 are scoring about 750 points on Geekbench. So there's a massive jump in actual performance of the device. It also has a gig of RAM versus 512 in the iPad 2, which means that multitasking is much smoother. And the last one, and I think this was actually the one that that closed the deal for me in my thinking, was the cameras are substantially better in the new devices than they are on the iPad 2. And if you think about how you use a camera in a classroom, you're essentially taking indoor pictures without a flash all the time. And if you've ever tried that on an iPad 2, the results are absolutely horrible. They are as close to unusable as you'll get. They look like impressionist paintings rather than photographs because of the level of noise in the camera. And I think that was the thing that actually pushed me over the edge in what I was thinking about, was these cameras are not very good, whereas the ones in the iPad 4 are really, really good. Now, you mentioned earlier, Bradley, about is it possible to take the iPad 2 on a short release and maybe refresh sooner? And I did look into that, and the answer is actually you can't make that work, because the iPad 2 is not cheaper enough that you can afford to cut a year off your lease and still come out ahead. Now, yes, if you leased an iPad 2 over 3 years versus leasing an iPad 4 over 3 years, of course that's cheaper because the device is cheaper, but it's not cheaper enough that you can cut a year off your lease, unfortunately. So that option had to go out as well.
Are you going to build in volume purchase program gift certificates into your price of your lease?
Not into the price of the lease, no. We're going to separate that out and do something different. I think what we're going to do, my intention is that for the senior kids, they're going to basically have, I mean, let's face it, most of them already have their own Apple ID, so it's not going to be a case of us having to set it up for them. I did a quick survey with some of my classes last week and found that about 60% of them already had their own Apple ID. So it's going to be just a matter of having them set that up on the school device, and then they'll have basically carte blanche to do whatever they need to do on that device. And we'll use volume purchase to give them versions of the apps that we want them to have, and then they can just do whatever else they want on top of that. We'll apply obviously some controls, some age restrictions and so on, but beyond that, I would like it to be that these iPads can be autonomous, connected to iCloud, and then I don't have to take either responsibility or provide hardware in the school to help them back up and so on. That can all be taken care of.
Yeah, we're kind of looking at trying to include some of those volume purchase program gift certificates in our lease, but it's hard to kind of calculate the amount of money you'll need, because you don't always know at this point what applications you're looking at for the next year. And it's kind of, especially with us, we've got some existing devices, so it's a lot of math. And so, but hey, yeah. at least you've got that option this go around to implement that. That should make your device rollout a little smoother and day to day.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to have to get my head into Configurator a little bit because I've got a list here I was just going to read out to you because we've got some... We went through an exercise about 6 months ago where we asked all the teachers, like, what are the baseline applications that everybody in the school absolutely needs to have and what are things that are kind of extraneous? And the baseline set is actually remarkably short. I thought we would have more in this, but we don't. And it's basically Keynote and Pages, not Numbers actually, as a baseline app, but Keynote and Pages, iThoughts HD, which is a mind mapping program, Procreate or ArtRage, which is our drawing simulator programs, Moxie or Collage, which is a digital collage application, a PDF, an advanced PDF annotator such as PDF Expert, which I like. That's my favorite personally. GarageBand, Photo Puppet, or some similar animation building program, Explain Everything, which is a great app for teaching and learning, Book Creator, which is a ebook builder application on the iPad, which is great, and iMovie and iPhoto. And that whole set comes to £25 per pupil in total. When I looked at that list, I thought, oh, this is going to be really expensive. I'm going to add it up. But once you get into volume purchase, that's the volume purchase price. Obviously, almost all of them are available on a 50% discount for volume purchase. So in the end, we're looking at, you know, £3,000 to kit out the whole school with that software through volume purchase. So that's going to be a big step to get into that. But obviously, you know, year to year, once we've bought that set, we won't necessarily have to, we're not going to spend that sum of money again. We're going to buy them for the new kids coming in and we'll possibly reclaim some of them back from the kids who are leaving. But that would be it. Now, obviously, there are other applications that go on top of that. But what we're going to do with that is we're going to say, you know, those are subject-specific applications. They're going to be listed in the iTunes U materials for those courses. And we're probably, not for definite, but we're probably going to say to parents, look, that's part of the equipment that you need for your class. You know, same as we would say a textbook for some, or for example.
Well, it's, you know, talking about the amount of money we're talking about seems like a lot. But if you remember back to the desktop days, this is pennies compared to it. You could never tell a kid, all right, we're going to give you a laptop. You've got to buy 10 applications. They would have $700, you know, per student. It's just like the price of this has come dramatically down. And it's great because you can kind of, I guess, have a little bit more, not fun, but you can experiment a little bit more. You can try something, and if it's terrible, you're not out that much money.
No. And if you look at this list, for example, you know, the things that in previous times you would have been buying to support this, you'd have been buying a whole suite of iWork, which was, before the Mac App Store, that was about £80 in the UK. iLife was a similar price. And then you're looking at painting applications that are kind of almost Photoshop-ish in some of their power. No, obviously not. They're not directly comparable to Photoshop because that is just a superlative application. But, you know, in terms of the way you would use it in school, things like Procreate and Brushes and ArtRage are, you know, they're pretty sophisticated drawing programs. And then PDF tools, for example, well, before Preview came along, that was an expensive thing as well. Building EPUBs and so on and so on and so on.
It's a nice model. I really like the way it's come. It's a lot easier to, you're kind of working with, you know, a one-stop shop. There's, you don't have five different companies to go create accounts with and manage licenses with. You just buy it through one interface. You've got one volume purchase program spreadsheet. It's much easier. I would definitely recommend, and this goes to all the listeners as well, I would keep at minimum one active Time Machine backup of the machine that is kind of your main Configurator machine. It, really, any machine that's running Configurator that's holding volume purchase program spreadsheets, keep a backup because that's one of the things Apple's going to tell you to do if you run into issues is restore from a backup. What you don't want to get into is having to rebuild your database from scratch. Now, money-wise, you're not going to be out any money. Apple will work with you to reissue active codes that you can then re-import. But, you know, like your situation, if you were trying to manage, you know, every one of your devices, 120 devices on one machine, and something goes haywire, and, I had an issue where an Apple configurator update caused everything to go haywire. You just want to have the ability to restore back to a day or so ago. So it would be well worth the money to buy a terabyte hard drive and keep a lot of backups.
Absolutely agreed. Yep, that's going to be a precious machine in the future. So the way I'm thinking about doing that at the moment is that I'll probably, for the primary kids, there will still be a kind of configurator-based deployment of some kind. For secondary kids, it will basically be, here's 10 codes that we want you to redeem. Make sure you come to school with the apps that are in your iTunes U courses for this year, and then you can do whatever else you want. And if the parents want to fund the kids to have more apps that are paid for, that's up to them. But we're going to have a baseline set that we all know as teachers. There's these 10 applications, and then there's the ones that I've asked for in my course. And then that's going to be it right there.
Yeah, I like that. I like, you know, going forward, thinking 5 years from now, you could even see where for maybe your middle and upper school that a configurator-based deployment just doesn't exist. It's, hey, you know, here's the device, here are the codes. You take care of the rest. You know what to do. Yeah. You've got your Apple ID already set up. It just makes it simple when there's not kind of one thing that could bring down the whole system of accounts.
Yeah. And there are other things to think about as well. You know, one of the things I've started drafting into our next acceptable use policy is things like you have to keep enough free space on your iCloud account to make sure your device can be backed up. You know, that's it's not that we're providing that backup space as much as we are by policy requiring that you keep that space and things like that. So it's kind of this process of, you know, responsibilizing, if you like, other people to take a bit more care of themselves. Because a friend from California was talking to me and he said, look, isn't it crazy that the way we do this with computers is that we baby children along all the way through school, and then when they get to college, it's down to them. And everybody has a data disaster in college because they haven't really got into the process of thinking about their data security. Whereas in school, you know, if a 7-year-old loses their entire contents of their iPad, well, it's upsetting for them, but it's not going to have a dramatic impact on their future with the data they've lost. So why not, you know, help them learn when it's safe for them to make a big mistake, and then hopefully they'll have figured that out by the time they get to where it will be. You know, the times in their life when it will be important that they don't make any mistakes with data and backup and safety and so on.
Yeah, that and there's a book, I think, The Value of a Skint Knee, I think is the name of the book, that it's good for kids to have those kind of failures and problems because it teaches them. And, you know, we even in the business world, people, you know, they just expect that somebody's backing up their stuff, so they don't really think about it as much at home. And so if you teach people, look, this is your data. Here's the backup tools that we have in place. You need to make sure that it's working. You need to check it to make sure that it's completing nightly. You need to check your iCloud settings once a week to make sure there's not an error message. Because I've seen, of course, I do run a couple of beta applications, and on occasions those have been the offenders. But I've seen situations where, for no apparent reason, the iCloud backup cannot complete. And so the process of fixing that is to turn off each individual application until you can tell. So you turn all, my process is I turn them all off and then turn them on one by one, you know, making a backup in between to figure out which one's messed up. So it's in some ways those kind of troubleshooting techniques that we can, you know, it's in our responsibility to teach children, you know, how to figure this stuff out, how to check your backups, how to make sure, you know, what they say, with great power comes great responsibility. You know, we're giving you a great tool that can hold all of your schoolwork. You need to make sure that it's backing up.
And it's nice that it's so built into the system now. You know, in times past, you know, the computer would never prompt you about backup or anything like that. But now, obviously, you've probably seen this yourself, that if your iCloud backup doesn't complete for a week, you'll get an alert message right on the front screen next time you unlock the device. And then a 2-week warning, a 3-week warning, and so on. So it's not as if the people responsible for it couldn't say, or could say, well, I never knew it wasn't backing up, because it was going to tell you it was not backing up once you've got the backup turned on. Now, obviously, if the settings have somehow turned themselves off, which doesn't seem to happen very often.
And that's a great teaching opportunity. Obviously, if a kid comes to you and says, Mr. Spears, I'm getting this message about my backup not finishing, I don't know what's going on, then you can then take the time to show them the settings, show them the iCloud settings, and explain to them how that works. So it's really a great teaching opportunity.
Exactly. You know, you look for these opportunities in so many other parts of school. This is one area that we can extend the teaching, if you like, because we, you know, normally, even when you do teach a subject like IT or computing, you don't teach the kind of systems administration side of it. You know, you give them a pre-configured computer and you say, okay, we're going to learn this or that or the next thing. But you don't really give them a fresh computer out of the box and say, okay, this is yours, make it work. It's a great opportunity, I think.
Because when they leave, you know, either high school or college, there's not a technical training on day one of their new job. It's expected that they know how to operate a computer, especially if they work on a computer daily. No one is going to explain to them, you know, how it works, you know, how email works. It's expected that they know these kind of things. And so if we don't teach them, you know, just basic computing skills, you know, basic maybe troubleshooting skills, we're really doing them a disservice.
Yeah, definitely. It's going to be interesting to see how it goes. Up till now, we've given kids a fairly controlled iPad experience in our school. You know, we'll deploy the apps, we have the syncing stations and all that kind of stuff. But obviously, as I say to people who come and visit our school all the time, I say, look, our deployment design is from 2010. It's from iOS 3.2 days and it's from iTunes 10 days. And please don't go home and do the same thing that we've done, because when it comes to the summer, I'm going to do things a lot differently around here as well. And configurators are part of that. But I also think there's potentially a role for, there's a phase of the school where I think configurator is perhaps no longer needed, certainly in a one-to-one situation. You could do a lot better, a lot more interesting things if you can just say, look, here's your device. Ask me a question if you're stuck with it. Of course, you know, we're here to help. But at the end of the day, this is an autonomous device now, you know, because in iOS 3.2 and 4 for that matter, the iPad wasn't an autonomous device. You needed a computer to make it, to get it started, to activate it, to update the operating system. And now all of that stuff can be done without ever touching a computer. You know, I've got iPads in this house now that have never been connected to iTunes for anything ever. And that's perfectly possible, you know. And I think we've proven that since iOS 5 came out. We've got enough miles under the tires, if you like, on that, that we know that that can actually genuinely work. It's not just it's a nice idea that we could cut the cord, but in reality, you still need the cord. We really, really know now that you can absolutely use an iPad or an iPhone as a completely autonomous device connected to the cloud that does not require substantial desktop or laptop infrastructure in the school to support it.
Now, how does it work, kind of fast forwarding to later in the spring? You finalized your lease and, you know, you're basically just waiting. Do they just show up like in one big shipment?
That's what happened last time. Yep. A guy drove up in a TNT truck and just rolled them off the back, and that was it, two pallets. Now, this is something to be aware of if MD's getting into this, is figure into your timing plans how long it's going to take you to unpack all of these devices, because it's going to take you some sweet time. Because the way it worked was that the iPads came in, they were in their retail boxes, and each of those boxes was in a box of five. So there was a number of boxes. We had to unpack each of those. Each of those had an iPad box in it. We had to unpack that. And then you've got to unwrap the iPad from its plastic. You've got to unwrap the charger or the cable and so on. And then label things, write down serial numbers, all that kind of stuff. Some of your better resellers will actually just provide you a spreadsheet of serial numbers that you've got. But we didn't get that the first time for whatever reason.
I'm assuming it's the same in the UK as it is in the US now, but when they kind of optimize that, I bought a couple of the 10 packs. I guess it was, maybe it was either 10 packs or 5 packs last summer. I forget which ones they come in, but they come, you know, come in the box, but then there's five smaller brown boxes inside of that. Yeah. And so there's no really iPad logo on it. All it has is a serial number. So the great thing about that is you could unpack them, and without ever actually opening the boxes, you could go ahead and inventory everything. You could use a scan gun. What I do for our iOS devices is I keep a number spreadsheet, and so you can go in there and just, you know, quickly scan those barcodes with an IR scanner, and then you could have everything inventoried. Then you could start unpacking it. And as far as I remember, I'm trying to think back, the boxes that actually contained the iPads, there was no tape on them, so it was very quickly to, you know, open, get them out, you're good to go.
Yeah, ours, I think, as far as I know, were just like the kind of way they get shipped to the Apple Store. We had the full retail packaging for our iPads and everything inside there, layers deep, including little cardboard spacers for the corners and so on. So we had quite a lot of paper to get rid of. But that's the way they came. It was four or five people helping. It probably took us about a day to unwrap everything.
It's a lot of time. Now that I'm thinking about it, I actually think the chargers come in their own box in those packs of 5 or 10. Okay. I feel that is actually also helpful because if you're kind of keeping those separate, you can kind of say, okay, these are, you know, you can kind of take those out and say, all right, these are the box of chargers, and you can even leave them in there until you're ready to hand them out to the kids.
Yeah, because you don't necessarily need them all lying about during setup.
It's a fun day. It's stressful too. Like, I have a smaller office, and so when you have all that equipment sitting in there, it kind of is like a little fort.
Yeah, you build yourself some fun architecture with that stuff. I think we still have all our retail boxes somewhere in the school. I don't know where they are, but we're going to find them. We'll probably get two cupboards back when we get rid of our old ones.
That leads me to my next question. What will you do with your old devices?
Well, there's a couple of, it depends a bit on your finance, what you can do with your old devices. Essentially, we've been offered for our next lease two different options, one of which is being referred to as a finance lease, and the other one is an operating lease. And the idea being with a finance lease that you've basically paid the entire value of the device over the cost of the lease. And the residual value that the leasing company might get is very, very small, on the order of, you know, £20 per unit or something, not a huge amount of money. Whereas with an operating lease, the idea is that you never really take title of the old devices. So you would then just send them back, and the leasing company would recycle them for money, and that would be their profit on the deal, let's say. So I don't know exactly what we're going to do with them yet. We've got a couple of ideas. I'm going to keep the big idea on that for another show, because I think it could be quite interesting if we can organize it all. So maybe after Christmas we'll talk about that, because we've got some planning to do over Christmas. And then I'll maybe tell you the story of that later on.
Well, that'll be fun. The way our current lease works is it was a dollar buyout. And so we basically had to pay a dollar to retain ownership of the device.
Okay.
If we wanted to, we have the option to sell them back to Apple for a set amount, depending on the model. They have Apple will send you a large spreadsheet with, if it's this model, it's this much. If it has this, it's this much. But what we're going to do, I think, with our Macs is sell them, because I think I can sell them for more than I can sell them back to Apple. So we're going to offer that to our school families. Like, hey, we're selling our old computers. They will include this. It's going to be this price. And then I haven't decided what I'm going to do with that money yet, because it'll be tricky. If it work out, I would love just to take that money and apply it towards the first lease payment, but the first lease payment will be in a different fiscal year. So it's not as easy to kind of keep that money. You kind of need to do something with it. So I'm not 100% sure. I may try to put it towards the lease we have on our Aerohive unit, or maybe do some other switch upgrades. I'm not 100% sure, because we're looking at selling them for $350 to $400. Now, these are 2009 white MacBooks. And I've got, trying to think, 30 or 40 that I could sell. So that obviously could be quite a bit of money that I would love to, again, either to pay down that lease we have on our wireless, or you can do some other network upgrades. We need to redo some switch links with fiber and some things like that. Things there's never a good time to do otherwise.
Yeah, no, that's true. One of the other options that we've got, I don't know if this is available through companies in the US, but in the UK, and one of the mobile phone companies, O2, will do a, how do they describe it? Like an electronics recycling program, where if you send them, they do it for consumers as well. You know, if you, I did it with my iPhone 4S when I moved up to the 5, you send them back your old device with the charger and the cable in the box, and they'll pay you a certain amount of money for that. And currently they're offering, for iPad 1s, they're offering about £104 per unit. So there's a possibility that we could recycle a number through that channel as well and make a bit of money on that, because the buyout price from Apple Financial is less than that, I think. So we could clear a little bit of money on that.
Yeah, that's kind of some unexpected revenue that you kind of most people don't think about until you end up with a boxes full of old devices. And especially with iOS and Macs, they generally hold their value more so than a PC would.
Yeah, they do. They do. I was surprised at just how much we could potentially make by recycling those. So that's kind of where we are at the moment. I'm not moving on anything just yet, because there is always this thing in the back of my mind that there might be yet another iPad refresh in March. I don't know if that's true or not. I have no inside information whatsoever in this, but it's just a couple of people, you know, Horace Dedieu, for example, from Asimco.com, has mentioned on his podcast that there are rumblings that Apple may be going to a less than 1 year refresh cycle. So I don't have to sign anything before March, so I'm not going to sign anything before March. But I think for now, the decision is we're going to go fourth generation iPad, and we're going to go over 3 years. And I think we're just going to go for a 16 gig one again. I'm not confident about that. That's probably a whole other show to think about data life cycle and so on. But this is obviously going to be the first iPads that we've had with a camera, and with a video camera at that. So we're trying to think of ways and techniques to get video off the device and onto some kind of cloud service that's not going to eat storage on the device over time. But we haven't quite perfected that workflow yet.
That'll be interesting. I think, you know, we could have another couple of shows when you actually get our gear, and we'll get our new gear this spring, talking about, you know, just the process of unboxing and getting those handed out. It's a really exciting time. It's kind of what I guess us in the business live for, is getting to do this kind of thing.
Yeah, that's our other Christmas for that year.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot of work, but it is definitely a lot of fun. Real quick, before we wrap up, don't forget about the contest that our sponsor BDOX is having, looking for people to share true stories of innovations, telling about how you've used timelines in your classroom to engage students. This can be using a BDOX product, the Timeline 3D for the Mac and for the iOS devices, or it can be a competing product, or even a cardboard, a poster board, and a pen. So really anything that you've used, you know, we want to hear about how you've used timelines. Send your story to story@bdocs.com, and that link will be on our website and in the show notes. The winner will read on the show, and it will be on the BDocs blog, and you will receive three prizes: a license for Timeline 3D for Mac, a license for Timeline 3D for iOS, and then a $25 App Store gift card. And if you already own one of the BDocs products, you have the ability to gift that to someone else as well. So again, story@bdocs.com.
Awesome. So this is it for 2012. Thanks to everybody who has subscribed. I don't know what our recent subscriber numbers are, Bradley, but we've seen numbers above 800, getting on for 1,000. Numbers in that?
Yeah, it's right around in there. Depending on, it's funny, it always seems to drop on the weekends. I guess people aren't refreshing their podcast apps on the weekends like I do, but it hovers anywhere from 750 to right around 1,000, depending on the week. And we're thrilled to get to do it. It's great to get to hear from listeners. Hosting a podcast is a little bit of work. And so when we hear from listeners that they're enjoying the show and it's causing them to think further in their day to day, that really makes it worth it. So it's really been a fun few weeks of doing this, and looking forward to more in the new year.
Yep. Here's to next year.
Yeah. Have a Merry Christmas, everybody. Yeah. And You know, again, I'm on the web at Chambers Daily and on Twitter at Bradley Chambers.
And Spears.org for my blog and Fraser Spears on Twitter.
All right. Well, have a Merry Christmas, everybody.
Cheers.